Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
If Taliban are opting for a military solution, that's a big miscalculation in their part.
With Afghan leaders in Washington to meet with President Biden, U.S. intelligence says their government could collapse within 6 months. I ask Afghan official Dr. Abdullah Abdullah, is it too late to save Afghanistan from the Taliban? And as Afghan women and girls face a Taliban resurgence, women around the world face disproportionate fallout from the coronavirus. UN Women head Pumzila Lama-Nzuka takes action to protect gender equality. Then,
it poses real threats to democracy and to American people.
For the first time, the U.S. government tackles domestic extremism. Michelle Martin speaks with author and historian Kathleen Bulu.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Rodriguez in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour. President Biden meets with Afghan leaders Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah at the White House today at a particularly challenging moment for their country. The U.S. military has already withdrawn more than half its remaining troops and equipment. The Taliban are seizing territory at an alarming rate, and American intelligence agencies say the government could collapse as soon as 6 months after the military drawdown is completed. Meanwhile, Afghanistan is battling the deadliest wave of coronavirus yet, with less than 1% of their population fully vaccinated. But with President Biden intent on ending the longest of long wars and bringing U.S. troops home at last, the talks today are unlikely to change his course. In a moment, we'll bring you my conversation with Dr. Abdullah Abdullah. He leads the Afghan government body that oversees peace talks with the Taliban. But first, correspondent Nick Robertson looks at the Taliban's advances.
In a recently overrun army base in northern Afghanistan, Taliban show off captured heavy weapons and ammunition. CNN cannot verify the authenticity of the videos or the date they were filmed, and Afghan security officials could not confirm or deny Taliban claims in these videos to CNN. But they do admit to losing dozens of towns in the past fortnight. The Taliban claim 90 such victories in the past month. The UN says it's less, 50 of 370 gone, but still very concerning.
Most districts that have been taken surround provincial capitals, suggesting that the Taliban are positioning themselves to try and take these capitals once foreign forces are fully withdrawn.
At times, the Taliban claiming wins without firing a shot. In Tahrir province, a whole column of up-armored American-made Afghan army Humvees are surrendered by government soldiers to the Taliban. The soldiers dump their guns in a pile, a valuable boost for the Taliban, who are fighting hundreds of miles from their heartland in the south and east. Afghan government officials say they're sending reinforcements to take back control and claim without proof to have killed hundreds of Taliban. The Taliban offensive appears to take advantage of the US and NATO drawdown, limiting air support for Afghan troops on the ground, and raises questions about their intent at peace talks in Doha with the Afghan government. It's also significant that they're attacking the north. I covered the Afghan conflict in the 90s when the Taliban were fighting their way up the country. It took them years to get up to the north. This will send a very chilling message to Afghans. The Taliban surge, also a concern for US forces, who agreed their own ceasefire with the Taliban as they exit their longest war, but hoped they might leave the country at peace.
Every day, the situation in Afghanistan changes as the Taliban continue to conduct these attacks and to raid district centers, as well as the violence, which is still too high.
On Friday, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani meets President Biden, with final U.S. forces more than half gone. Hard to see an easy reverse to the Taliban's gains.
And our thanks to Nick Robertson reporting there. Abdullah Abdullah was chief executive of the Afghan government, and he now oversees the High Council for National Reconciliation, the official body in charge of negotiating with the Taliban. When I spoke with him earlier today, I asked him what he most needs to achieve in Washington today. Dr. Abdullah, thank you so much for joining us this morning and welcome to the program. The U.S. is expected to complete its withdrawal of 3,500 troops over the next 2 weeks. The AP is reporting 650 troops are expected to remain to continue to provide security for diplomats there. In your assessment, how well is the military withdrawal being handled in your country right now?
The main reason for this visit is that while one chapter is closing, which is the presence of the U.S. troops and NATO troops in Afghanistan, how to shape the new chapter of cooperation, which the administration has expressed its readiness to continue its support for the people of Afghanistan, for ANDSF, and the rest of it. Personally, how I would have preferred it, that's a different issue. Now there is a decision, and we have to work together to avoid instability, further bloodshed. My job as the chairman of the High Council for National Reconciliation, to do everything possible diplomatically, politically in the region with our friends to avoid further instability and bloodshed in our country.
As you mentioned, you and President Ghani are in Washington, D.C. for 2 days of talks. You met with a bipartisan group of senators yesterday about the continued support that the U.S. will provide for Afghanistan. And you tweeted, "We address stability, peace prospects, and future bilateral priorities and key appropriations. Bipartisan support is strong." What is your most pressing ask of the U.S. government right now? You know our politics. You know it is very rare now to see any bipartisan formation within Congress, and yet you have bipartisan support. What is your biggest ask of Congress?
We had extensive discussions, both with Majority Leader Schumer, Senator Schumer, Minority Leader McConnell, Senator Menendez, Senator Resch, and a bipartisan group of ranking members of the Senate. They all expressed their support and continued commitment for the people of Afghanistan for two reasons, mainly for stability there, but also to prevent further threats from terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda to the Americans, homeland security, and also to the region in peace and stability in that part of the world, and also to prevent suffering of the people of Afghanistan, and especially women of Afghanistan, and also how to preserve the achievements of the people of Afghanistan, which is the result of so much sacrifices by the Americans, by our international partners, especially by the people of Afghanistan. And a lot has changed as a result of that support. So it will be like support for ANDSF in the security sector, which we have discussed, and we will later on discuss it with the administration. Economic support, humanitarian support, diplomatic support, and the messaging part of it is also important because of what Afghanistan went through in the past few decades. Now that the troops are withdrawing in a few days or weeks, then the people are saying that the United States will disengage from Afghanistan.
When we throw it in, and again, you haven't yet to have this meeting with the administration, but just from the numbers that we're hearing, 3 million doses of vaccines, over $3 billion in security assistance, over $200 million in humanitarian assistance, is that enough, in your opinion, to satisfy the huge needs that your country and Afghanistan is going to need over the course of the next few years?
It's important. It's a big symbol of commitment in action taking in that regard, and also we are working together with the U.S. as our partner, our lead partner in supporting Afghanistan with other partners as well. But it's very important at this stage, the support when the vaccines, the third wave of coronavirus has hit us harder than it is known outside to the outside world. That's important, humanitarian support, and also the bigger package of support. I wouldn't say that it will address all the needs of the people of Afghanistan, but we also need to work hard within the country to generate revenue and also work with other partners to continue their cooperation and support.
I was just going to say, let me pick up on what you said in terms of what needs to be done internally and on your end, because President Biden is likely to press you and President Ghani to unify your rival political factions in the face of a rising threat from the Taliban. And this is something that Wendy Sherman, the Deputy Secretary of State, said earlier this week to Christiane. Take a listen.
We are not withdrawing from Afghanistan. We are just withdrawing our troop presence and changing our posture. When President Ghani and Dr. Abdullah come to Washington this week, we will reassure them of our presence, of our continued support, and our continued support for a peace negotiation to ensure that there's really sustainability for Afghanistan. We will also encourage them to unify their country and to build the future that is necessary for the Afghan people.
So my question to you is, how important is that, the fact that you are being asked to unify your internal factions against a rising threat from the Taliban?
It's critical for us. This is perhaps the most important thing to do. And we have been busy working on that. And the country also have shown its unified voice when it comes to the inclusive, peaceful settlement. Of course, Taliban position is different. I mean, the majority of the people of Afghanistan, an absolute majority of our people, they are for a dignified, durable, lasting peace. And there, the people have shown their unity. And also when it comes to the Taliban intention to press for military solution, the people have shown it in support of the government, but more work needs to be done. And the Taliban will be disappointed if they were making a calculus that then they will be dealing with divisions and differences, and that will provide an opportunity for them. We need to disappoint them.
I don't have to tell you that there are tens of thousands of Afghanis who are now fearful of their life as the U.S. presence is withdrawing from Afghanistan. And more than 18,000 alone have worked as interpreters, as drivers, as engineers, as fixers, as security guards. There have been more than 53,000 applications from family members seeking to leave the country. Just this week, the administration said that they're going to be notifying lawmakers that they will begin a wholesale movement of tens of thousands of these Afghanis to a third-party country. What more can you tell us about this? What is your reaction to that?
Of course, there are certain precedents to that. And also, recently, when Taliban made some progress, they captured some districts and the people have been displaced inside Afghanistan. The concerns about the future security of the country is growing amongst the people, but we are there to, with the people of Afghanistan, and our partners have assured our people that they will continue their commitment. When it comes to the asylum seekers or those who've served in Afghanistan, their concerns are understandable, but we need to discuss in some details with the administration how best to handle it. So these are part of the capacity which was built for Afghanistan and in Afghanistan. And it's our prime responsibility how to assure our people that we are going through a difficult times, and that we need to stay together. Leaving the country might not be an option, but we do understand concern, especially with those individuals which worked very closely with the forces there.
We have seen this in the past in U.S. wars, whether it be in Vietnam, whether it be in Iraq, and this plight to get asylum seekers out of the country, those especially that had been aiding the U.S. military. How important is it for Afghanis to see that the U.S. step up this time as well?
So it's I have a different feeling as a citizen of Afghanistan under difficult conditions and circumstances. To leave the country will not be a solution. We need those people to help us in dealing with the challenges that we are faced with. But meanwhile, I cannot talk for every single individual in its concerns, its worries for its family, and so on and so forth. Officially, I will leave it for our own government to discuss the details of it with the administration.
And obviously, this entails the Taliban grabbing a stronger hold of the country. You mentioned them taking over 50 districts in Afghanistan through mediation and military offenses there. The U.S. Intelligence community, I'm sure you've heard, offered a bleak assessment last week, saying that the Afghan government could collapse as soon as 6 months after this military withdrawal. But I want to counter that, because the U.S. Defense Secretary Austin and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Milley, told a Senate hearing last week that they believe there's just a medium risk of terror groups like the Taliban regaining strength in Afghanistan. And they said it could happen over the course of 2 years, not 6 months, like the IC is saying. So you're on the ground there. Which assessment do you think more accurately portrays the situation?
Those analyses are based on the accounts looking at the situation from different angles. But a military takeover by Taliban, as a person who has gone through different experiences in the past 4 decades and has stayed in Afghanistan, I would say that that's, inshallah, God willing, it's impossible. They may try, they may some immediate or midterm success, and we may face some setbacks, but if Taliban are opting for a military solution, that's a big miscalculation in their part. That's defying the lessons of the history. Afghanistan has changed, and they need to evaluate the risks of that. They are opting for the continuation of the war. Suffering of the people will continue, but they will not achieve their aims.
They're saying, though, that they're not even going to begin negotiations or are considering some of these asks until all U.S. troops leave the country. There are more fears of a rapid Taliban takeover of Kabul. And I'm reminded of something that you said last year, not even a year ago, in September, when the days of these talks in Doha were relatively early. And you described the atmosphere of these talks as healthy. You said, quote, "We sense that there is a willing in the other side, which is the Taliban movement, to take advantage of this situation and contribute." So were you overly optimistic, and what went wrong?
So I was optimistic at that time, because I thought that Taliban main demand was the withdrawal of the international troops, or the main excuse for continuing the fight. And they had promised that they will reduce violence significantly with the start of negotiations. They had promised that they will participate in negotiations in good faith. They had promised that they would de-link themselves with Al-Qaeda. None of those issues, those commitments are under question. And all of those are under question. And then during the negotiations, they wasted time. and also their actions on the ground, unfortunately, proves it other way around. So this is what we went through, and this is what they had said, that they are for a peaceful settlement of the situation. There is no military solution. That was in the opening statement of the Taliban leader, which was there. So I'm still optimistic. I'm not losing hope on the on achieving a peaceful settlement, but current situations, the current challenges or realities on the ground, unfortunately, shows the other side of the concerns that we had. While I was saying this at that time, in the back of my mind, there was a very serious concern. What if Taliban intention was to appear to be negotiating without really engaging in serious negotiations and also waiting for the withdrawal? Perhaps that's what they are thinking. And also, I'm sure that this is not the thinking amongst the overwhelming part of the leadership of the Taliban. But that's the dominating view, perhaps, today.
And obviously, their actions are speaking louder than their words and their promising words just last
yes.
year. And my question based off of that is, what do you say to half of your population being women who are concerned now that there's going to be a huge step backwards to all of the achievements that they've seen over these past decades and their rights, even going to school?
Yes, and there were some hopes that Taliban may have changed because they were saying that we have made mistakes in the past. And again, in the areas that has come under their control, the first thing that happens, the schools are stopped for girls. But no, this is something that we are going through, and I mentioned earlier as well, in immediate term, perhaps even midterm, we will be faced with these challenges. But all those achievements of the people of Afghanistan, especially half of our population, cannot be reversed. Yesterday, talking to the veterans, they were saying that what our service, our sacrifices, our loved ones, is it in vain? My answer to them was no, absolutely not. First, you have served a bigger cause for humanity in dealing with the biggest challenge, perhaps one of the biggest challenges of our time, which is terrorism. Together with the people of Afghanistan, we have made sacrifices. But as a result of our joint sacrifices, life for millions of people have reversed, including in the areas of women's role in the society, politics, economy, everything, every walk of life. Freedom of expression, never seen in Afghanistan, never exercised in Afghanistan in the past. And awareness of the people about their rights, educated population. Perhaps Taliban are thinking about 90s, when Afghanistan was completely isolated from the rest of the world. There was a proxy war taking place in the country. Economy was non-existent. And the situation was extremely challenging. That's not the situation anymore in Afghanistan, but together we have to deal with this challenge.
Dr. Abdullah, we appreciate your time and good luck with your meetings today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, as Afghan women brace for what may be ahead, the United Nations is continuing to warn that the COVID-19 pandemic is threatening to reverse progress on gender equality all over the world. Indeed, the World Economic Forum estimates that COVID has added another 36 years to the goal of closing the gender gap, a goal that it now predicts will take more than 135 years. Unbelievable. Pumzile Lambu Nzuka is the executive director of UN Women, gearing up for a big conference in Paris at the end of the month. Pumzile, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us here from New York.
Thank you very much for having me.
Before we start talking about your initiative in that conference next week, I have to get your reaction from what we just heard from Abdullah, because there are a lot of concerns out there that people who are going to be paying the biggest price of a Taliban resurgence in Afghanistan are women and children. In fact, Amnesty International says the two decades of hard-won progress by Afghan women is now really in jeopardy as the U.S. troops leave. How concerned are you about the plight of women and girls?
Well, we are absolutely concerned, and we don't think that the women of Afghanistan have to fight this just by themselves. This is a global problem. It needs global solidarity. The conference that we're planning is to put on the platform issues of this nature that needs all of us to focus together on the issue.
Talk about more what we can expect out of this conference next week. Obviously, it's a joint partnership that's sponsored between Mexico and France this year. What are your biggest initiatives and hopes, obviously, as the world still is battling through the pandemic?
Well, we're hoping to accelerate the implementation of the agenda for women, which was already slow even before the pandemic. What the pandemic has done has pushed it backwards. So we are hoping to accelerate the implementation of the SDGs, the Beijing platform, but this needs money. One of the biggest focus, therefore, for us is the fundraising, is calling on private sector, on governments, on philanthropists, on individuals to actually donate money that could help us to accelerate the implementation of this, because we sort of know now what needs to be done, where it needs to happen, but we just don't have enough money, resources, and resolve, which I must emphasize, to take this forward. So we need countries to choose policies that they will take forward, such as the care policy, which has not been there before. Thinks that the U.S. is taking this very seriously. But now we have a coalition of countries that are coming together that will push forward the care economy. We have gender-responsive policing, where we're bringing together a cohort of countries that will be focused on gender-responsive policing. And we are also bringing in young people in a significant way, because, as you know, the majority of the people on earth today are young people. If we do not put them in strategic places and support them to move forward, we will not have enough people going forward to take things forward.
Obviously, the focus right now is getting the vaccine to as many countries that are in desperate need as possible. The humanitarian crisis is just devastating throughout parts of the world, especially as these new variants are appearing. But longer term, I know that your focus is on the financing that can go directly to help women and children recovering from the pandemic. We spend a lot of time in this country talking about the impact of the coronavirus on women and the setback that we've seen in the United States and the U.S. economy. 2 million women had to be left out on the sidelines and leave the workforce to care for children and their families. I'm not sure enough attention is placed on women throughout the rest of the world, however, especially in developing countries.
We certainly are highlighting the impact of not vaccinating women in many countries. As you know, the reason we are fighting for women is because women are always at the last of the queue. We have fears that there are countries where when vaccinations are available, women will be at the last. So we are pushing that women and men must together be forward. We are not saying men must be at the back, but we're certainly saying women must not be at the back. But we are also preparing for the day after the vaccination. Where do women go from here? Because women in the informal sector have had their businesses closed. Women have experienced violence. Women have the burden of care. And women also do not have the digital literacy skills that are required for them to make the move forward in the new work that is going to be available in the future.
And for those who may think that this is sort of a transitory period and that things will go back to somewhat of a normal situation, though they were never on parity even before COVID, you look at some of these statistics, UNESCO estimates that 11 million girls may not return to school after the pandemic. This isn't just temporarily not returning. This is permanently not returning. What is the significance of that? And talk about the setback that is not only from a humanitarian standpoint in a gender equality standpoint, but for overall economies too.
This is very significant to us, and we say it does not have to be like this. We can find these girls and send them back to schools. We are doing that right now to some extent, but we actually need to agree at this conference to bring girls wherever they may be and take them back to schools. And you need governments to support this and be part of this process. That is why in this conference, we have heads of state, heads of corporations, heads of private sector, head of philanthropies, youth organizations, because young people have been the most vocal about girls and their friends that they are not seeing back to school. And this can be stopped. It doesn't have to end like this. These girls are too young. We cannot allow a situation where a 16-year-old girl's life has just ended. Because if they are married now, if they are trafficked now, this actually means that they are being sentenced to poverty.
Malala Yousafzai addressed some of these issues last September when she addressed the UN General Assembly, and I want to read what she said. She said, "Our goal should not be to return to the way things were, but instead a renewed commitment to the way the world should be, a place where every girl can learn and lead. As a child, circumstances beyond my control plunged my education and my dreams for the future into uncertainty. Right now, a generation of girls is in the same situation." Can you give us some specifics on what can be done to fulfill what she's saying, what she's pleading for the world to address?
Yeah. What Malala is saying is that we should not accept the fact that there are girls who are not at schools and that's the end of story. That is not the end of story. These girls are alive. They are here in the countries that we live in. We need with the ministers of education to actually go and get the girls back and put them back to school. It is the responsibility of the ministries of education, of civil society, of parents to make sure that the girls are being brought back. We need to unmarry the girls that have been married and take them back to school. We've seen that happen in Malawi, happen in Zambia, where girls have been taken back and have been liberated from marriage. By becoming a child marriage survivor, you have another opportunity to be a child again. And of course, we need to make sure that children have access to digital infrastructure, literacy, gadgets, in order to make sure that their own education also continues. That is true also of teachers who need to be in a position to teach these teachers. At Generation Equality, these are commitments that have been made by the people who will be at Generation Equality. And I hope as many of your viewers will log in, will register to Generation Equality. They can go into my Twitter account. They will see how they can register. They can go to UN Women. There is step-by-step registration there. We need them to be there because we want to hear their voices.
Are you satisfied with the amount of resources and attention that both the United States and other Western nations in Europe in particular are devoting to these issues?
Well, we don't know for sure right now what we are going to get. We will be knowing that because each country will declare what it is bringing forward. I think the day after we will be able to say, you know, where we sit on this. I must say, UN Women, as the smaller agency of the UN, has always had the very little money that is available that goes around. So for us, it is important to move absolutely where we are, because otherwise this is a disservice to women to support them and fund them at the level at which we are funding now. This is a full-blown push by women from all over the world and by other stakeholders who have lost patience waiting for someone to save them. I think we are the ones who are to save the women. If it's not us, who?
So well said. You have been a lifelong champion of women's rights before you even had this position right now at the UN. My question to you is, what message would you send to a young girl right now in a developing country who's had to quit her education if she had the opportunity to even have one? And who is concerned about what her future looks like? Do you have words of optimism for her, or are you, in fact, concerned about her future?
Well, I am concerned about her future, but I have not given up. We need the girl to go out and find the people. In every country, there are people who are looking for girls like that. There is so many of us who want to take these girls back and put them next to school. I always say education is the next best thing next to a silver bullet. While we don't have a silver bullet for gender equality, education is one thing that we have, and we must use it everywhere we can, for every girl, whoever they are.
I guess finally, can you explain to a broader audience why this isn't just an issue that's important because it's the right issue to focus on, but it's one that will help the global economy overall and men as well?
By leaving half of the population outside the labor market, outside education, outside productivity, you actually reduce the economy. This is not a nice thing to do. This is something that the world needs. But of course, it's also a right thing to do because women's rights need to be respected. But without respecting women's rights, men are actually disrespecting themselves because they also lose out. Countries become poorer, they underproduce, and in that way, we are unable to address the food insecurity that exists in many of the countries.
Phumzile Lambo-Nzuka, thank you so much for shining a light on this very important topic. We appreciate it. Best of luck at the conference.
Thank you very much. Please be there.
Thank you. We will. We will cover it. Thank you. Well, turning now to the U.S., the Biden administration is rolling out a new strategy to counter domestic terrorism, the very first of its kind. And one of its top aims is to confront the longstanding drivers of homegrown extremism, racism, and bigotry. This as the first Capitol rioter is sentenced. Award-winning historian and author Kathleen Boulou is a professor at the University of Chicago. Her work traces violence and militarization in American life and how to combat it. Here she is talking to Michelle Martin.
Thanks, Bianna. Professor Kathleen Boulou, thank you so much for talking with us.
Of course.
Now, a lot of people know your work from your 2018 book, which chronicled the rise of white power activism from Vietnam to the Oklahoma City bombing. Could you just tell us the direct line between the white power movement and what happened at the Capitol on January 6th?
The white power movement was the coming together of an assortment of different groups and activists immediately after the Vietnam War. So what we saw is in the late 1970s and early 80s, Klansmen, neo-Nazis, and then later skinheads, militiamen, tax resistors, followers of Christian Identity, and white separatists all got together with the common goal of waging war on the American government. They declared that war in 1983 and then adopted cell-style terrorism. And sort of propagated a number of violent actions leading up to a massive seditious conspiracy trial in the late 1980s, and then major altercations of the federal government in the early 1990s. That takes us up to the Oklahoma City bombing, which happened in 1995. Now, that's the largest domestic terror attack in our nation's history, and it's the biggest mass casualty event in American history between Pearl Harbor and 9/11. But most of us still don't remember that as the work of an organized social movement rather than, you know, a few bad apples. Between Oklahoma City, which, by the way, increased militia activity, and the present, what we see is the reorganization of this movement online, and sort of the spinning out into a bunch of new forms. So today, this movement came out into public discourse again with the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville and has really been on the march since.
How did it start? What is it that happened in that sort of post-Vietnam era that created this kind of, whatever this is, what would you call it, this movement, I guess?
I think the thing that really brought these activists together was a shared experience of the Vietnam War. Now, for some of them, this had to do with literal combat in Vietnam. And for veterans and active duty troops that came into the movement in its early formation, that certainly was the case. But this story about the Vietnam War became something much bigger and broader and something that was open to people who didn't fight and open to women and open to younger activists. And the idea was sort of that the government was the site of betrayal, the site of all problems and a direct threat to their nation. So the Vietnam War was really the catalyst that brought these activists together. And it also provided the uniforms, language, tactics, and weapons that escalated the impact of this movement over the years that followed.
But why that direction and not another direction? I mean, the Vietnam War was catalyzing to a number of movements, but why did it take this kind of vicious, violent, kind of anti-racist direction for the people for whom it did?
One of the important things to know here is that we're not talking about a story that's representative of Vietnam veterans or of veterans as a whole. This is a tiny fraction of people within that broader population. And just as you say, the Vietnam War was a catalyzing experience in the other direction for a great many people who found new sort of other kinds of political activity coming out of that experience. But this is actually part of a longer arc of activity. We can see that across the run of American history, the best predictor for surges in right-wing violent activity and militant activity, the best predictor is not poverty or immigration or reactionary mindset or the advances of communities of color. The best predictor is the aftermath of warfare. We see surges of the Klan after the Civil War, after World War I, after World War II, after Korea, after Vietnam, and we're seeing one now with the global war on terror. I skipped the Gulf War, but of course the Gulf War fueled the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, which was carried out by a white power activist with other movement connections. And one thing to think about here is that this is really not just veterans. In fact, the research shows us, coming out of sociology, that all measures of violence are higher in the aftermath of warfare. So it isn't that war is creating violence among these groups. It's that these groups, which use opportunistic recruitment and radicalization practices, are able to take advantage of this broader disaffection and violent tendency in society in those moments. And that's what really escalates their membership numbers and creates opportunities for violent impact.
Well, you know, you said something earlier that fascinated me. You said that women play a significant role in this movement. I don't think a lot of people realize that. Like, what role do women play in this?
If we look at the history of this movement, women were incredibly important. They did work in softening public perceptions of what people were doing. They did symbolic work of symbolizing sort of the race under attack and the reproductive capacity of white women. And they also did real on the ground violent work, like driving getaway cars and disguising people and designing secret insignia. They ran their own newspapers. They drove other activists to and from the airport. This was a big network of people. And the other thing to remember is that at the bottom, this was a social movement. People in the inner circles of the white power movement went to church in the movement. They homeschooled their kids with curricula from the movement. They went to marital counseling in the movement. They stayed at each other's houses when they drove across the country. This was a deeply imbricated social network. And that's what gives it the power to wage acts of violence the way that it does.
As we are speaking now, the first people connected to the mob attack on the U.S. Capitol have now been sentenced. The very first person sentenced was a grandmother of five, says she's remorseful, sentenced to 3 years probation. First of all, what's your take on the adjudication of this case and what we've seen? And what have we learned from all the people who've been arrested and charged so far?
Yeah, I think the big thing to remember is that what we saw on January 6th is really the collision of a bunch of different currents in sort of right-wing politics. One of them is simply the Trump base, which was sort of ginned up by ideas about the stolen election and by false information and fiery speeches. Some of them were there to perhaps wreak havoc, but a lot of them were there simply to demonstrate. That is well within their rights and part of our accepted political culture. Then we have some people that are a little bit trickier to deal with here. So we have QAnon activists who are engaged in a deep set of conspiracy theories that calls for violent action. And we have white power activists. And that last thread is where I think the serious action on January 6th came from. It's where the weapons came from. And it's also the thread that brings with it generations of mobilization and strategy honing and cell-style terrorism and paramilitary camps and serious military-grade weapons and materiel. That thread is the thing that I am personally most concerned about. So my guess, I'm not a legal specialist, but my guess is that the charges will focus on the people who really were there to provoke a violent assault on our democracy and will not focus on the people who were simply caught up in the moment or there as part of a speech action. That is what, as a citizen, I hope will happen.
You talked about the fact that one of the things that concerns you most about the mob attack on the Capitol is that I think you've described it, I'm not sure what word you exactly used, but it's kind of a rehearsal in a way. And so what's the goal here? What's the end game? Like, what do these people think they are going to accomplish with this?
So in any social movement, there is, of course, a variety of goals and a diversity of viewpoints. And that's even more true in this case, where the Capitol action really brought together white power activists, QAnon followers, and sort of more garden variety Trump supporters. Those three groups function differently, and we wouldn't want to paint them all with the same brush. But when we're thinking about white power activists who have been at this for decades now, and who have a long track record of activity and have a long history where we can see not only what they say they're doing, but the actual record of action, it's very clear that the playbook here is still coming from a set of strategies adopted in the 1980s, including those presented in the Turner Diaries, which is a dystopian novel that lays out some of this idea set. Also leaderless resistance, which is effectively cell-style terrorism. And that set of strategies is oriented towards waging war on the federal government. It's oriented towards the overthrow of the United States. And it's important to remember that for those activists, the nation in white nationalism is not the United States at all. It is the imagined Aryan nation of white people that is transnational. So we shouldn't think of this as white nationalism the way that people think of sort of overzealous patriotism. This is a profoundly anti-American movement. And it poses real threats to democracy and to American people.
What do you make of the increasing identification of the Republican Party with elements of this movement? I mean, according to a poll by the American Enterprise Institute, the poll found that nearly 40% of Republicans think political violence is justifiable and could be necessary. We find that a majority in some places of, in some polls, a majority of Republicans are adopting this falsehood that the election was stolen from the former president, you know, Donald Trump. And in fact, we see that the party apparatus in a number of states have been taken over by people who have adopted this falsehood. So what do you make of that?
Absolutely. And I would just add to the list of concerning information, things like the GOP issuing a talking points memo asking us to direct our attention away from white power organization after the El Paso shooting was carried out by a white power gunman. Things like people distorting the idea of what happened on January 6th as a normal tourist visit. All of that is deeply, deeply distressing because now we're talking not only about sort of the radical fringe that might carry out an act of violence, we're also talking about the way that fringe has impacted and corrupted our democratic norms and our mainstream politics. Now, I think reasonable people can agree that we should have a bright line dividing our political process from people who would like to overthrow it and install autocracy.
But we don't have that bright line. It's, I guess, what I'm saying, Professor Ballou. Yes. We do not have that bright line. So what does that mean and why is that?
So my question is, what is the work we haven't done in understanding our own history that makes those distortions possible? In other words, why don't we have a story about the Oklahoma City bombing as an act of social movement terrorism? Why don't we have, until this year, we haven't had appropriate resources devoted to this problem. We haven't had widespread public concern. We haven't had changes in journalistic and other kinds of public discourse norms around how we report these stories. We still think about lone wolves when we should be thinking about a groundswell. And until we make that set of changes and really confront this whole set of problems that run across many different scales of our society, I just don't see how we can confront this problem.
And what does that look like? What would it look like to confront this in the way that you think is necessary?
I think we need a set of policy changes ranging from the kinds of things that have just been proposed in the counterterrorism strategy set forth by the Biden administration to the sorts of reforms that are being considered by the Department of Defense now, to resource allocation, changes in laws, changes in structure, changes in journalistic norms, and also changes in community resources. One of the things that I really like in the new national security strategy is the allocation of resources at the local level for support for de-radicalization, support for teachers and librarians and parents who see people going down this rabbit hole and don't know what to do. Nobody wants to call the FBI in that situation when it's your kid or your student. We need resources for those people and those families. And we also need resources for communities that have been impacted by this. And that is starting to be more and more and more communities, such that Pittsburgh and El Paso and Charleston need to understand that they've been impacted by the same thing. Those are acts of anti-Semitic violence in Pittsburgh and anti-Black violence in Charleston and anti-immigrant violence in El Paso. But those are also all acts of white power violence. Those gunmen have a shared ideology. They read each other's manifestos. They have in real life and sometimes online connections. We have to understand all of that as part of the same problem and the same problem as the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and Adam Waffen and the Base. All of that is the same groundswell. We should be thinking about it only with degrees of difference. We shouldn't be treating them as different stories.
But yet we find that these governmental entities, particularly at the state and local level, which are dominated by Republicans, are obsessed with Black Lives Matter, Antifa, whatever that is or whatever they think it is, and critical race theory. What we see is this groundswell of concern about the teaching of alternate narratives around the presence of African Americans in the society who are, if I may remind us, 13% of the population. What's that about? What's that about?
Absolutely. And I mean, look, I'm a historian, so I'm very aware that when you have a hammer, everything is a nail. But I really think this is about insufficient understanding of our shared history. And when I say our, I mean the denizens of the United States, the people who live in this terrain. There's a lot of people who live here and who've lived here under different kinds of freedom and unfreedom for many, many centuries. And we owe it to each other to have a real conversation about evidence-based history that we have come from together. And I think, you know, the United States is not alone in its history of racial inequality and racial violence, or even in its history of systems and laws that have disproportionately benefited white people. And I think an overwhelming number of scholars agree with that premise. But the United States is sort of alone in how little we as a public have grappled with that history that we descend from. And this doesn't need to be about American and un-American. This is about the story that we all come from. It's a matter of basic truth finding.
Okay, Professor Blue, I respect that this is the work of your life. I respect that it is greatly important, but I, as I'm sitting here 15 miles from where I live, you know, hundreds of armed people assaulted the Capitol with the intention of overthrowing an election, and then who knows what else. So forgive me if I'm having a little trouble with the concept that a better teaching of history right now is going to address a problem like that. And so, so forgive me, but like what else?
A better teaching of history isn't for the people who are marching on the Capitol. It's for people coming next. What we need is that alongside a broad array of public policy solutions that tackle this problem at many different levels. This is urgent all across our society. So for instance, we have problems with infiltration at the Department of Defense. We have problems of infiltration probably in police departments, but we don't know because there's no central record keeping. We have problems of local radicalization. We have problems with insufficient trauma resources and mental health resources for communities impacted. And we have problems with massive availability of weapons and other kinds of material that end up in the hands of these groups. And here I'm talking not only about the sort of basic issues that we as a society share with available firearms to anyone, but also the fact that these groups have routinely gotten their hands on stolen military weapons and material from posts and bases, and that that problem has been with us since the 1980s, and here we still are with this in 2021. So as a historian, I'm interested in both the solutions we need right now for the crisis, and I'm interested in longer term conversations about our shared history and legacies that can position us for more equitable exercises of democratic franchise going forward as well.
Kathleen Belew, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
No doubt, proposals to ensure a more harmonious union. And finally, an update concerning one of humanity's early relatives with the discovery of a new prehistoric human species in Israel. Its name is Nesher Ramla Homo, and it dates back more than 100,000 years. Researchers are calling the finding a breakthrough that changes what we know about the origins of Neanderthals.
We can rewrite in a way the history of the development of Neanderthals. Now we can say that it's probably that they originate in the Levant, in our region, rather than in Europe, as many researchers thought until now.
Fascinating clues to our evolutionary history. Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.